From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, filling in for Terry Gross. The story of Yung Chang's family reads like a history lesson of China. Her grandmother was raised in a feudal society and given away as a concubine. Her mother smuggled secrets to communist forces during the Civil War, was arrested, and barely escaped execution before a firing squad. Coming up, a talk with Yung Chang, author of Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China. Also, we meet the man who scares Stephen King. He's British writer and filmmaker Clive Barker. His new novel of the fantastic is called Imagica. And television critic David Bianculli reviews two of the new shows this fall, Good and Evil and Brooklyn Bridge. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A pro-Iranian kidnap group in Beirut issued a statement today saying that it will release British hostage Jack Mann within 48 hours. The statement from the Revolutionary Justice Organization said that Mann would be freed as a result of immense efforts by UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. The statement was accompanied by a photograph of American hostage Joseph Sisipio. The Revolutionary Justice Organization is believed to hold both Mann and Sisipio, and the photograph was used to authenticate its claims. President Bush addressed the United Nations General Assembly in New York this afternoon, beginning 2 days of meetings with world leaders at the UN. Linda Fasulo reports.
In an otherwise low-key and philosophical speech, President Bush pledged to keep sanctions on Iraq as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. And he condemned a 1975 General Assembly resolution equating Zionism with racism and called for its unconditional repeal. Bush made his tough statement on Iraq after hearing news that UN inspectors were barred from leaving a Baghdad office building with vital documents about Iraq's master plan for nuclear development. Speaking of the Zionism resolution, Bush also insisted it had made a mockery of the UN's claim to work for peace, and a repeal would enhance the world body's credibility. The president said that the Cold War was definitively over and the West had won. However, he said he was not interested in imposing what he called a Pax Americana. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
In Yugoslavia, the ceasefire in Croatia, agreed to on Sunday, appeared to be holding, and there were only a few skirmishes between the Federal Army and Croatian forces. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
This is the first truce in Croatia in the last 3 months to last more than 24 hours, and signs that it could hold for at least a few days have convinced Lord Carrington, chairman of the European Community Peace Conference on Yugoslavia, to go ahead with a scheduled conference meeting Thursday in The Hague. But there is widespread feeling here that this will only be a momentary lull in the fighting. Croatian leaders seem to have understood that their forces are outnumbered by the Federal Army and need time to reorganize and obtain more weapons supplies. But even the Federal Army needs a breathing space. The armed forces is facing logistical problems and unexpected difficulty in calling up reservists in Serbia, many of whom have gone into hiding. This is Silvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. Analysts said that investors appeared to be concerned over predictions for lower corporate earnings in the third quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9 points to close at 3,010.5. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 142 million shares. This is NPR News. Armenia has joined the growing number of Soviet republics that have declared independence. The Armenian parliament voted overwhelmingly today to break away from the Soviet Union. The declaration came just 2 days after more than 99% of the voters in a referendum called for independence. Armenia now becomes the 12th of the 15 Soviet republics to formally break away. A religious belief apparently triggered the hostage siege this weekend at a maternity ward in a suburban Salt Lake City hospital. A gunman killed a nurse's aide and held 9 people, including 3 infants, hostage for 18 hours. NPR's Howard Berkus has more.
Neighbors of 39-year-old Richard Worthington say he barged into a Sandy, Utah hospital Saturday because his wife had an operation there that prevents pregnancy. Worthington is Mormon. And neighbors say he was distraught because he could not fulfill a strong Mormon belief. The Utah-based church teaches that childbirth brings to life unborn souls waiting in a pre-life heaven. Mormon officials also encourage couples to not bear more children than they can handle. Karen Worthington had 8 children, but apparently decided to have no more after several difficult pregnancies. Hostages say that Richard Worthington threatened to kill his wife's doctor and blow up the hospital. Police say they'll file charges in the case later this week. They also say jailers are watching Worthington closely after a failed suicide attempt yesterday. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
A survey of economists around the country says that the economy is recovering, albeit slowly, and is unlikely to fall back into a recession. The National Association of Business Economists released its quarterly poll of 56 economic forecasters today. The report said that the economists also expect inflation to remain moderate and interest rates to show little change over the next few years. Nearly 80% said they believed the recession ended in the second quarter. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. My guest, Yung Chang, grew up in China worshiping Mao Zedong. Her parents had been heroes during the Communist Revolution of the 40s, and they lived a privileged life among the communist elite. But during the Cultural Revolution, Mao turned on Chang's family, and they were sent to labor camps. When the political climate relaxed in the 70s, Yung Chang returned to her home city, where she worked as a steelworker and an electrician. Later, she was allowed to go to England to study, and she became the first person from the People's Republic of China to receive a doctorate from a British university. She now teaches at the School of Oriental and African Studies at London University, and she's written a book about her life and the lives of her mother and grandmother called Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China. This family history follows the history of China as it moved from being an isolated feudal society to a communist world power. Until she began writing this book, Yung Chang didn't realize how shocking and dramatic her mother and grandmother's life had been.
I knew a little bit. For example, I knew my grandmother. My grandmother died in 1969 when she was 60, and I was 17 then. And I spent my childhood with my grandmother. My grandmother had this bound feet, which was, you know, not just to put a piece of cloth around her feet, but only the big toe was allowed to grow, and the other 4 toes and arch were crushed under a big stone and then bound to stop the bones from recovering. And when I was a child, I used to see my grandmother soaking her feet in a bowl of hot water, sighing with relief and saying to me that, you know, every day it's just excruciating pain. And then she would cut the rotten skin and the flesh with some special knife. And then, of course, to cut the toenails, which had grown into the flesh. So I knew some of my grandmother's tragic stories. But the book mainly was told to me by my mother when she came to visit me in 1988. And then for the first time ever, she told me a lot of stories about herself and her mother. It would have been impossible for her to talk even to me under Mao when I was in China.
Tell us a little bit about the China of your grandmother. She was born in 1909. And as you write about it, you say, and it's, I think it's true, it was a very feudal society. Tell us about some of the specifics of her life.
Right. Apart from the fact that her feet were crushed and bound when she was 2, she was given by her father to this warlord general as his concubine when she was 15. In the early 1920s, China was ruled by warlords. My grandfather was the police chief of the warlord government in Peking. My grandmother was sort of married to him for a week, and then he disappeared for 6 years. And during their 10 years of marriage, my grandmother only saw him for less than a month. The rest of the time, she was a virtual prisoner in this house he bought for her under the watchful eye of his servants. Her life was... was a prisoner. I mean, she couldn't even pace the house because of her crippled feet. And the warlord had one proper wife and many other concubines.
Can you describe in some more detail about this act of binding the feet? Now, you said earlier that the big toe was allowed to grow. How exactly were the feet bound?
Only the big toe was left alone, and then the four other toes and the arch were crushed, were bent and crushed under a big stone. And then a piece of long, thick cloth was wound around the feet to stop the bones from growing. The ideal feet were literally 3 inches, and the heading of my first chapter is 3-inch golden lilies. That is the Chinese expression describing this kind of feet.
You describe this whole process of binding feet as a very kind of erotic experience for men in China, a kind of a foot fetish. And yet you also say that the truth of the matter is that the feet are rotting in this being bound.
Yes. In the erotic Chinese literature, you often read about descriptions of men sort of playing with women's bound feet in bed. In fact, if you see Chinese erotic paintings, the women were naked except their feet. In other words, the men never saw the feet. The feet were covered even in bed. Because the moment you let the feet go, they would grow again.
How long were your grandmother's feet?
It was just over 3 inches. I brought a pair of shoes and I showed various people, and they were all absolutely shocked. And you couldn't imagine, you know, how an adult feet could fit into this thing. But of course, my grandmother's feet were unbound when she married to a Manchu doctor in her 20s. And then the feet was magical, that the moment you let the feet go, they would grow. So today you actually don't have women with that kind of tiny feet. One reason was that when the communists came to power, they ordered all women to unbind their feet.
I'm wondering, though, if your grandmother's feet were broken by a stone and then bound, certainly in the early parts of her life, mm-hmm. did her feet look like feet, or did they look like an infant's foot, or were they more deformed than that?
The length was more like a child feet, but they were, of course, completely deformed. I saw my grandmother's feet when I was a child. I mean, the four toes were completely lifeless and with no bones. And it was crippled, and she was crippled. And of course, the whole thing was that the bound feet was done by the mothers, like my grandmother's was done by her mother. I mean, she would scream and from the pain, and she fainted. And her mother then had to gag her with a piece of cloth and said, you know, this is for your own good. And if I, you know, don't, if I relent, and when you grow up, when you get married, and you would be discriminated against by your husband's family, you would live in shame, and then you would blame me for having been weak. This, of course, was the case with many other women.
Your grandmother was a concubine to a Chinese warlord. Mm-hmm. How was she able to escape?
The warlord lived in his own mansion at the foot of the Great Wall, which was far away from where my grandmother lived, which was Manchuria. When he was dying, he summoned my grandmother to his place with my mother, who was an infant then. And as soon as my grandmother arrived, her daughter was taken away from her, because by tradition, the blood descendant had to be raised by the proper wife and not by a concubine. And my mother was not allowed to call my grandmother mother. And so my grandmother realized that when the warlord died, the wife would have the power to dispose of her, and she could be sold to a brothel, in which case she would never be able to see her daughter again. So she decided to escape, and she had the help of another sympathetic concubine. And so she escaped and went back to Manchuria.
Your mother grew up under the Japanese occupation, which began in the early 30s in China and went really through the end of World War II. How would you compare living under Japanese occupation to this Chinese feudal society that you're just describing?
Of course, in my grandmother's time, women were no longer confined to the four walls of their house. So my mother had the freedom of, going to school and walking about. But, I mean, she saw plenty of Japanese atrocities. For example, a 14-year-old school friend of hers by accident stumbled into a secret Japanese arms depot. She was caught and tortured and then executed in front of the whole school.
Why did your mother join the Communist Party? What did the party offer to her?
When the Japanese surrendered in 1945, my mother experienced different rulers. At first, there were the Russians. I mean, the local people welcomed the Russians as their liberators, but soon found that the Russians brought new problems. One was rape. Once my mother was chased down the road by a jeep load of Russians. And then the communists, Chinese communists came briefly. And then Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang came. And the Kuomintang was welcomed by the local people as their hope. But soon their hope was smashed. Kuomintang officials were hopelessly corrupt and inefficient. Inflation was horrendous. When my mother had to pay her school fees, she had to hire a rickshaw to carry the banknotes. And, of course, also there was this the age-old cruelty against women. Largely stayed. My mother was introduced to the communists by a friend of hers who was a 17-year-old girl but who was forced by her family to marry a 12-year-old boy. That was the tradition. Xiaonüxu called the a grown-up girl was married to a boy so that she could bring up her husband.
Are you saying that then your mother was afraid of a kind of return to the China of her mother?
That's right. And also the communists were the only force at the time to offer an alternative. And they were the only people who said, we are going to change all this.
I'm speaking with Yun Chan, and she's the author of a book called Wild Swans, and it's the story of her grandmother, her mother, and herself living in 20th century China, for her grandmother under the feudal regime of the early 20th century, and for herself and her mother under communism in the second half of the 20th century. Yun Chan left China in 1978 to study in England. She lives there in London and teaches at London University. We'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Yun Chan, and she's the author of a book called Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China. You were born into the Communist Party's upper echelons, I guess we could say. How different were the conditions of your life from the average Chinese person? Were there true privileges in the communist system?
Absolutely. I lived in this ward compound, which is a huge place with guards guarding the gate. I had literally no contact with ordinary Chinese lives. And it was a world full of privileges and hierarchy. And I grew up taking all this for granted, so much so that when I first came to England in 1978, I thought England was wonderfully classless.
What were those privileges?
My father had a bodyguard and he had a chauffeur. We had servants and we had wet nurses. I was brought up in my initial years by my wet nurse. And when in 1953, when my family traveled from the town called Yibing to Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan, by train, there were four different compartments, four different classes of compartments for the whole group. Like my mother would be in a separate place, my grandmother in a different place, my wet nurse and me in a different place, and the bodyguard in a different place.
When did you join the Red Guard?
I joined it, the organization, when I was 14, at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And I had grown up sort of intensely under this intense personality cult of Mao. Mao was my god. And I mean, you know, when I went on this pilgrimage to Peking to see Mao when I was 14, and I didn't see him, and I was heartbroken and thought of committing suicide. And so when Mao ordered as young people to join the Red Guards, and I joined, but I was appalled from the very beginning and left as soon as I could within a couple of months.
What did you witness? What did you see?
And the one thing the Red Guards did was to beat up the teachers. I saw one of my teachers being beaten by the boys. I was called by these boys to go and witness the beating because I was regarded as this teacher's pet. I mean, she just sort of praised me sort of in the lessons and when she sort of berated the boys. And so they really, they kicked her. And they made her kneel on the ground and kowtowed to them and said, Red Guard masters, please spare me,
Did you feel that you could express any emotion as you watched that?
I was absolutely appalled and terrified and so I in fact left halfway through this. In fact, in 1989, I went back to China researching this book, and I went to see this. I had a long talk with this teacher, and we had some photographs taken, and together. And when we thought about the past,
your parents were accused of being capitalist roaders. What were their specific crimes?
There were many people accused of being capitalist roaders, and this accusation was not so much for what they had done or what they had to say, but for anyone who was the head of a section, of a unit. But as for my parents, my father was one of the few who stood up to Mao and voiced to Mao his opposition of the Cultural Revolution. So my father was arrested, tortured, and driven insane. In fact, Madame Mao personally condemned him and said, for a man like this, death is too easy for him. We must thoroughly smash him before we have done with him. And my mother was asked to denounce my father, and she refused. She also went through over 100 so violent denunciation meetings. She was made to kneel on broken glass, and she was beaten and tortured. And psychopath in those days had a wild time because their cruelty was sanctioned, encouraged, and indeed glorified. My mother developed a hemorrhage from her womb and would often faint. Mm-hmm. And they both were expelled to labor camps.
Did you wonder at that time why the outside world either wouldn't or didn't intervene during the Cultural Revolution?
The idea actually didn't occur to me, the idea about the outside world. China was totally isolated from the outside world. America was, of course, presented as the number one enemy. When I was a child, the word hello was described as a swear word. the outside world was just completely remote to me. And when I was a child, also, if we didn't eat up our food, our nursery teacher would say, think of all the starving children in the capitalist world.
Of course, you know, we have our own version of that.
That's right. And of course, also in the Cultural Revolution, for the limited outside response that sort of featured in the Chinese official propaganda was all praise. And the people were praising Mao as the greatest, one of the greatest leaders of the 20th century. People were praising the Cultural Revolution. And I'm very sad to say that much of that seemed to be true at the time.
You went to London in 1978 to study. And I wonder what your thoughts were when several years ago students took to Tiananmen Square in China to challenge the government. Did you want to be there?
I was in China researching my book when I saw the build-up of the demonstrations on Tiananmen Square. In fact, my initial reaction was amazement, how lack of fear these people were. Because when I lived in China, fear was everyday life. I mean, you couldn't even contemplate a demonstration. I mean, you would kill any thought of dissent in case this thought leaked out inadvertently and endanger yourself, your whole family, your friends and your relatives. So I was amazed. And then, of course, when the army opened fire, most people were shocked. And I couldn't believe my eyes when I was in London, back in London, watching television.
Would you say that the communist regime in China is even stronger since Tiananmen Square? Have they used that incident to consolidate their power?
The communist regime in China today is very different from the Maoist days. I mean, the door has been opened, and it can't be closed again. And the concept of liberty, the concept of human rights, and so on, have entered into the Chinese consciousness. And the regime can't take that out again. So the population has changed.
Asia Watch has documented human rights violations, tortures, detentions, executions. What pressures do you think the outside world can bring to bear to bring greater reforms and freedoms in China?
I think the outside world, it just has to keep going on and on about this human rights issue. And also what I think is most important is we mustn't just focus on the prisoners. Of course, I mean, you know, we've got to focus on the prisoners, but we've got also have to realize that repression in China takes many forms. For people even living outside the prison, their life, their freedom is extremely limited, and they can be under many different forms of repression. And we must speak for these people as well. And I think we want, maybe the outside world should press the Chinese government to at least to make some effort to establish a proper legal system, which would be the guarantee of human rights in China.
Yun Chan, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you.
Yung Chang's book is called Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. A lot of people have said that Clive Barker's work is nothing more than gross, scary stuff. But Barker says that what he's doing is nothing less than exploring humanity's timeless mythology and bringing it into the 90s. Coming up, Clive Barker talks about his latest book, Imagica. And television critic David Bianculli tells us about two new programs from the creators of Soap and Family Ties. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi officials reportedly held a team of UN weapons inspectors in a building in downtown Baghdad for over 13 hours before letting them go. The team is said to have found evidence of an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports from the UN.
The inspectors went to the building early Monday. There they found what UN officials called comprehensive documents regarding Iraq's nuclear weapons program. When they tried to load the documents into a vehicle and leave, Iraqi authorities blocked their way. For more than 13 hours, the Iraqis held the inspectors inside the building. Then, according to the State Department, the authorities forcibly ejected them. The inspectors reportedly had to leave the documents behind, but the Iraqis promised them they could see them again on Tuesday. UN Security Council officials called the incident very, very serious and met today to talk about what to do. Speaking before the UN General Assembly, President Bush said the incident underscored Saddam Hussein's contempt for UN resolutions. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Iraq's foreign minister to the UN has denied that his country is trying to keep anything hidden concerning its weapons program. The Iraqi officials said that a reported detention of a UN team was a non-event and that all material taken from government facilities must be documented. President Bush today, in a speech before the UN General Assembly, called on the international body to repeal its 1975 resolution equating Zionism with racism. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said the controversial resolution mocks the principles upon which the United Nations was founded.
Zionism is not a policy. It is the idea that led to the creation of a home for the Jewish people to the State of Israel.
To equate Zionism with racism, said the president, is to reject Israel itself, and that the UN cannot claim to seek peace and simultaneously challenge Israel's right to exist.
And to equate Zionism with the intolerable sin of racism is to twist history and forget the terrible plight of Jews in World War II, and indeed, throughout history.
The president's appeal was widely viewed as an attempt to soothe tensions between his administration and Israel. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Iran, officials say that eight opposition figures have been put on trial on a charge of siding with enemies of the state and are now in prison. It's the first report on the trials by Iran state media and comes amid indications of growing discontent over the failure of the Iranian government to improve living conditions. The charges against the eight were equal to treason. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 9 points to close at 3,010.51. On Vima, some 145 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia, a new ceasefire, failed to stop fighting between the Federal Army and Croatian military units. But despite the struggle for important towns, much of the breakaway republic has been quiet. According to the Yugoslav news agency, by nightfall, the fighting appeared to be easing, except for the eastern part of the country. In Croatia, there are about 600,000 Serbians, many of whom do not want to live in an independent nation. In Miami, a witness in the trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega said today that he received orders to lie about alleged drug money transactions involving Noriega. Lieutenant Colonel Luis Del Cid says the orders came indirectly from Noriega. NPR's John Dingus reports from Miami.
Del Cid was Noriega's bodyguard and later his personal secretary. He said today that he twice delivered envelopes he thought contained drug money to Noriega. He said Noriega instructed him to pick up the package from a pilot, Floyd Carlton. Both Carlton and Del Cid were indicted with Noriega in 1988 and charged with drug trafficking. Del Cid testified today that when the indictments were announced, he was asked to appear before a Panamanian attorney general who was investigating the charges. He said Noriega told him at the time to obey the summons, but another one of Noriega's officers, allegedly acting on Noriega's orders, told Del Cid what the questions would be in the inquiry and told him what answers to give. Del Cid said he then lied in his Panamanian testimony, denying he had delivered the money to Noriega. In Miami, this is John Dinges.
In Beirut, Lebanon, a group claiming to hold hostage Jack Mann of Britain says that he will be released within 48 hours. A note said that the Revolutionary Justice Organization had decided to free Mann after what it termed immense efforts by UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. No one could accuse Clive Barker of not having a rich fantasy life. From his earliest novels, The Book of Blood, The Damnation Game, In the Flesh, he has uniquely blended horror with eroticism. Barker is said to be the guy that Stephen King considers scary. Besides his novels, and they're nearly 10 by now, he's directed the movie versions of his books, including Hellraiser, Hellbound, and Nightbreed. Children are being introduced to his world through comic book versions of his stories, and next year Barker will publish his first children's book. In his last few books, Barker has moved from horror fiction to something more fantastic. Imagica is Barker's latest novel, in which he's created a complex fantasy world. The title refers to a universe of five dominions. Earth is one of those dominions ruled by a tyrannical leader. Barker told me that he's not that different from most novelists who create their own worlds.
I think every novelist considers his or herself a minor divinity. I think that the writer of the fantastique is much more likely to want to sit down on a mountaintop and say, okay, the world is relatively bare, let me begin it.
This world that you've created and the kind of mythology and mythological creatures in the world that you have created, do you think people need somehow a kind of mythology, that there is a kind of barrenness
absolutely.
A lot of the way people live their lives and these sort of large, as you say, fantastique kind of universes meets the kind of need for mythology?
Yes, I think we must be clear, though, that the need is not a neurotic need, because I think very often it's thought to be and it isn't, and that the work isn't necessarily escapism. Game shows are escapism. Presidential addresses are escapism. Confrontation with the mythologies in us, confrontations with the spiritual possibilities of our lives can actually be ways to stir up all kinds of thoughts and ideas in us. I'm a Jungian, and I believe passionately in the collective unconscious. I believe there are images and ideas which are constants across cultures. And in Imagica, for the first time, I've dared to do something which I simply wouldn't have had the courage to do 3-4 years ago, which is reconfigure the Christian myth. And if we take Jung as the gospel for a moment and accept the power that Jung ascribes to mythologies in our lives, then finding new ways to tell those potent tales of our culture and asking people to reassess them, which is something that Imagica does, in, I hope, a very entertaining and sexy package, but nevertheless that's what it's hoping to do, that seems to be a very important thing to do.
One of the characters I find interesting is Paiopa, who is a mestif, who's kind of characterized by having the ability to be both genders.
Right.
You seem to be saying that sexuality doesn't fit very neatly into the categories of male and female, that there's a lot in between,
Absolutely.
Lot of sort of undefined sexuality that
Absolutely.
Most people probably don't explore or even try to understand.
Well, I think that in the last 10 years we've seen a rise of a whole psychological movement which is about the male finding the female inside him and the female looking to find the male. I mean, whether we look at Robert Bly, whether we look at a whole body of writers dealing with the problems of gender definition. In our culture, the old means of gender definition are sort of a bit redundant. You know, I do very little hunting daily now, and you know, women do far less domestic work, sitting at home looking after their children.
Or scrubbing the clothes by the river.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Though my mother does do that still. We have a very nice river in Liverpool. But no, exactly right. Those definitions don't pertain any longer. And I think what we get, therefore, is this sort of cultural caricature of those roles, which is actually repugnant. We get Sylvester Stallone on the one hand, and we get the oversized mammaries of Playboy on the other hand.
Well, I think what that represents is people clinging with
absolutely
desperation
absolutely
to these models of
and
sexuality,
sort of caricaturing them, you know, because they still excite the old system somehow or other. And the dormant part of the meek accountant's mind is excited by the image of the ultimate hunter-gatherer, Sylvester Stallone, as he sits watching Rambo. This has to go. But what we need in its place are new metaphors which are making sense to our to our consciousness. And part of my problem with the fantastique as a narrative model, as it appears at the end of the 20th century, is how unambiguous and unparadoxical it's become, how much it's a business of the bad guys versus the good guys, how much horror fiction is a business of throwing the monster out into the ether, never to see it again, how much the Tolkien model, the Lord of the Rings model, has been used to divide the world up into those innocent, hairy-footed hobbits and the terrible, dark things that live in the mountains. This isn't the way the world is. The world is full of ambiguities, and I want that to find its way into my fiction.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Clive Barker, and he's back with another book. His latest book is called Imagica, and his films, and he's done several, include Hellraiser, Hellbound, and Nightbreed. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Clive Barker is my guest. Do you ever scare yourself?
No. No, these are my children. They may be twisted, they may be freakish, but I love them.
Did you ever scare your parents?
I still scare my parents. My parents are scared by the fact that there is such a huge audience for this stuff. I mean, that's what really, no.
It's the company you keep.
It really is. My mother and father are wonderful people. My mother's part Italian, my father's part Irish, very voluble. They're great storytellers, very excitable, and really wonderful people. They don't like this stuff. They don't understand this stuff. It's no part of their world. They're pragmatists. They were brought up at a time, you know, they came to adulthood through the war. It was a very difficult time in England. They married during a time of great economic depression when there were still ration books and so on. They had to be pragmatists. That was necessary. I was, on the other hand, born into a lush time when my imagination was given a lot of freedom in my education, which my parents weren't.
Well, I wonder, even your doodling as a child, I mean, they must have come across some of your drawings or listened to the sort of stories you would
They were deeply
tell.
Distressed, and I feel their distress was in part a response to pragmatists to the fact that they had given birth to a congenital dreamer. And what was this about? Where the hell did this come from?
Well, did they go so far as to take you to see a therapist somehow?
No, because, in 1955 in England, therapy was something, there was probably only one therapist in all of England. I mean, therapy wasn't in. And even in England now, therapy doesn't have the same, credence that it has here. So, I mean, that was never an option. They did take the pieces of paper and crayons away from me very regularly. Mm-hmm. They did try and make me draw houses and trains.
What did you draw? What were you drawing?
Dragons and demons, of course. But they were what my mind's eye was seeing. Mm-hmm. And later, when I was 15 and 16, discovered William Blake, a story came to light there, which I particularly loved. Blake was walking on Peckham Rye with his mother and father and stopped at a tree and gazed up and his mother and father, who were extremely sensible people, said, "What's the problem, Bill?" And William said, look at all the angels. Look at all the angels in this tree." And they looked up at what was clearly just a tree full of leaves as far as they were concerned. And I think they were wrong and Bill was right. And said, "Oh, boy, dear, oh, dear, I'm sure somebody's going to invent psychoanalysis really soon and we'll be very glad," and took little Bill away. And that tale moved me greatly because... though until recently, certainly until the Magicka, I tend to have put emphasis upon the dragons and the demons, I was also seeing the angels. And that's a more and more an important part of my life.
Did that set you apart then also from kids that you might have been playing with?
Yes, but I didn't much mind that. I was a solitary, short-sighted, rotund little boy who didn't really care that I suppose I cared on sports day when I didn't get to play the games because I couldn't and didn't want to. But what I really cared about was having access to the secret world of the imagination and holding on to that. I felt through my childhood and actually through my university years too as though I was constantly besieged by pragmatists, besieged by the particulars of living a life. And I didn't want to live a life. I wanted to dream a life.
Were there people, though, that did encourage you, or was this really a solitary process?
There were a few, and I've thanked them at the beginning of books. There was the inevitable English teacher. I spoke to Steve King about this. It seems to me as though we all writers have an English teacher somewhere there who was encouraging in an atmosphere where... maybe encouragement was lacking elsewhere at home, perhaps.
And is one enough? I mean, one teacher is enough?
I think it's enough. I think all you need is one soul who will say to you, quietly perhaps, after the class is over, hold on to this, because this is wonderful. And I only required that. It was actually one conversation at 4 o'clock in some autumn, sometime when I was 16 or 15 or 16, and it was all I needed.
You're working now on a book for children.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clue us in at all to you're dealing with?
The first things that we put into the hands of our children are very important. We put Never Never Land and Oz and Wonderland into our children's hands, and then, of course, we take them away at the age of 4 and tell them they're wholly irrelevant to their lives. It's just a terrible thing to do. But... my mother was wonderful. She put into my hands very early on Peter Pan and a little later Treasure Island, the Narnia books and so on. And then I discovered, I suppose at the age of 8 or 9, I discovered Ray Bradbury. And something Wicked This Way Comes became my sacred text for 2 or 3 years. And the hold that those books and those worlds had upon my imagination was so fierce that I can still smell the feeling of those books. And I mean smell the feeling. I can still sense what it was to be involved in those worlds and walk with those characters and fly with those characters. And I thought it was time to see if I couldn't put into the hands of another generation a story or two like that.
Do you find you have to be more careful in the way you write for children?
Well, there's fewer cuss words and sex scenes. but there is a real sense in which there's a continuum between the works of the Fantastique and the things which I read when I was a child. The sense that the imagination is still the true law, perhaps the only real law, is something which is held over from childhood, from the fiction of childhood. You see, Paul is wrong when he says, now you're a man, you put away childish things. It's one of the fundamental lies of our culture that we divide into this thing called the child and this thing called the adult. What we do is we sublimate all the passions of childhood and very often do them the most terrible mischief in the process and do ourselves the most terrible mischief.
I wonder, too, in trying to get these ideas and your books into the hands of children, you have to go through parents, you have to go through teachers, librarians who might not believe quite all the things that you believe about childhood.
Of course, but I'm a proselytizer. You've noticed that. I think in a culture which celebrates so much banality, it's inevitable that one has to fight for a kind of fierceness of the imagination.
Well, I think it's nutrition. I think people are very interested in kind of nutritious kind of literature that's good for children, will make them into good citizens.
Yes, exactly right. And then good workers. I mean, there's a whole argument made about what you're trying to turn children into. And actually what you're trying to turn them into is engineering plant fodder, retail work fodder. And there's something else that we are born to, and it isn't 8 hours of reductive imagination-breaking work a day. There is the life of the soul. There's the life of the spirit.
So are you interested in turning children into subversives?
I think children are born subversives. And what I'm asking them to do is hold on to that part.
Clive Barker, thank you very much.
This has been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Clive Barker's newest novel is Imagica. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the stories they're covering on the news today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we'll be hearing about President Bush's call at the UN for repeal of the General Assembly resolution that branded Zionism a form of racism. Also, the difficulties UN inspectors are having with the Iraqis as they tried today to take with them documents of the Iraqi secret nuclear program. We'll also have a report on the Cuban-American community in Miami as it contemplates the possibility of a post-Castro, post-communist era on the island. And we'll be talking with Harry Wu, who went undercover to visit Chinese prison camps.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up later today on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. Two veteran television producers have new shows out this season, Gary David Goldberg, the creator of Family Ties, and Susan Harris, the creator of The Golden Girls. TV critic David Bianculli checked out their latest efforts, and he says only one is worth watching.
Susan Harris made her reputation in the late 70s with Soap, a wild soap opera spoof with outrageous characters, cliffhanger endings, and suggestive dialogue. With Good and Evil premiering Wednesday on ABC, Harris has done it again, but that's not a compliment. What she's done is remade Soap for the 90s. Good and Evil focuses on a family that made its fortune in the cosmetics business. There's a good sister and an evil sister, which is where the title comes from. Margaret Whitten is good and Terry Garr is evil. When they share a scene together, it's supposed to be a study in contrasts. But in the two episodes I've seen, it's more like a graduate course in bad sitcom writing.
We need to talk about Mother's new boyfriend.
Do we?
Well, I know she needs companionship, but I've never seen her... You know.
Pay for it?
Right. It's obvious Harlan's just a common, you know.
Gigolo?
Exactly. And unless we protect her, Mom could get, you know.
A really nasty venereal disease?
Apparently, Susan Harris has confused outrageous with outdated. The first two episodes of Good and Evil both include extended scenes of Mark Blankfield as a blind man, knocking things over and accidentally threatening people with his walking cane. Not only is it a straight steal from W.C. Fields and others, but in Good and Evil, it's not funny, only offensive. And the only things more offensive than the sight gags are the sound gags, which, for a supposedly adult comedy, are amazingly juvenile.
David, boy, are you one lucky bronco. You're rich, you're young, you can still see your willy without using a mirror.
Each episode ends with the same kind of teaser that Soap did, and basically does everything else that Soap did, only worse. Soap never was as good as its reputation, but at least it was different and had some really good comic actors, like Billy Crystal and Richard Mulligan. Good and Evil isn't even different from Soap, and it certainly isn't good. Brooklyn Bridge, however, is good and different. It's by Family Ties creator Gary David Goldberg, and it's a comedy, with no laugh track, about his Brooklyn childhood in the 50s. Mix up the styles of Woody Allen, Neil Simon, and the Wonder Years, and you get some idea of what to expect. One thing you can't prepare yourself for, though, is the performance by Marion Ross, who plays Grandma Sophie. On Happy Days, she played America's quintessential white bread mom, Mrs. Cunningham. On Brooklyn Bridge, she's almost unrecognizable as a Jewish grandmother. And like everyone else in the cast, she makes even the little scenes believable and charming. Here's a typical morning scene with young Alan, played by series star Danny Gerard, coming downstairs to the kitchen where his grandparents are waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning. What do you want for breakfast?
What are the choices?
Blintzes, cream of wheat, pancakes, French toast, eggs, bagels, waffles, herring, or oatmeal.
That's it?
There's not enough. That's more than I have at the automat.
It's better, too.
I'll have Blintzes, please.
And for lunch, then?
Oh, I think I might be going out for lunch.
Oh, I think you're coming home.
I think you're right. I'll have a tuna fish sandwich. Not too much mayo, please.
And for dinner?
Do I have to decide right now?
I have to know what to defrost.
Only been up 8 minutes. It's kind of hard to get excited about dinner.
Peek.
Well, that brown paper looks good. I'll have what's in there.
Pot roast. Don't be such a smart guy.
Brooklyn Bridge premiered last Friday and arrived for review late enough to be one of the season's few last-minute surprises. And a pleasant one at that. Add Brooklyn Bridge to the list of shows worth watching. And while you're at it, make sure to subtract Good and Evil.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. He reviewed Good and Evil and Brooklyn Bridge. Fresh Air's producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, novelist Norman Rush tells us about writing in a woman's voice, living in Africa, and being a conscientious objector during the Korean War. His new novel is called Mating. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. That and more on the next Fresh Air.